Hi, and welcome to the Africa for Zero Waste podcast, where we delve into impactful conversations on zero waste initiatives and highlight the stories of individuals driving innovative solutions across Africa. My name is Marissa Naidu, your host for today's episode. Today, we're back with an episode around the Global Plastics Treaty and diving into our topic titled Courage, Not Compromise, What It Will Take to Break the Consensus Deadlock at the INC 5.2. Now, before we dive into our conversation today, allow me to set the stage for you. Right now, the world is working on a global plastics treaty, which is a landmark agreement that could help tackle the plastic pollution crisis. But unfortunately, this process is facing major roadblocks. The negotiations have been significantly stalled by a small group of petrochemical and plastic producing countries. These countries are using the consensus-only decision-making process to delay real action under the idea that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. In the international negotiation space, consensus means no country objects when a decision is adopted. But to make real progress, ambitious negotiators need to break free from being stuck in a consensus deadlock and use their sovereign right to call for when a vote is needed. Voting happens to be a legitimate tool. It allows for convergence, real agreement, instead of letting one or two countries block the will of the majority. In practice, relying on consensus can kill democracy. It forces decisions down to the lowest common denominator, often resulting in weak or watered-down agreements that we have sometimes seen in the past. So, as the Plastics Treaty talks continue, the question is, will negotiators stick with consensus and risk another weak agreement? Or will they choose a path that actually lets the majority move forward? With that, allow me to get into the discussion for today. And I am joined by an exceptional lineup of experts. Firstly, allow me to introduce Dr. Jamala Jin, who is a PhD candidate and is a policy and science advisor for the Break Free from Plastic movement and is also based within the Center for Coalfield Justice. I'm also joined by Mohammed Kamal, who is a member of the Gaia and Break Free from Africa Plastic Movement and is the Executive Director at Greenish Foundation in Egypt. I also have with me Kabir Arora, who is the General Secretary of the International Alliance for Waste Pickers, and Serene Rashid, who is a Science Policy Advisor for Gaia Global. Welcome, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us today. I think we can now get started. So my first question I have is for Serene. Serene, we would like to know how you view and understand the concept of consensus in the landscape of multilateral environmental agreements. Help us unpack this key concept so that we can start understanding the details behind this.
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad to be here with you today. So in relation to consensus, I'd like to start off with the concept. Consensus should really be understood as the absence of a clearly formulated objection when a decision is adopted. And why clearly formulated? Well, this is because consensus should not be understood as unanimity, right? Should not be understood as all countries in the treaty or in the treaty negotiations positively agreeing to the decision. Although in some spaces like the UNFCCC, consensus is interpreted by the chairs as a unanimity. In fact, some scholars are saying that we should emphasize that there is a third way. There is an option not only to agree or to object and block agreement, but also to stand aside or abstain, to express disagreement or uncertainty without blocking the decision itself. What can be politically very challenging is when there is consensus as a rule for decision-making, and then there is an objection, but that gets overruled by the chair. This happened at the climate COP16 in Cancun, where Bolivia's objection to the adoption of the so-called Cancun Accord, which was a weak text, was overlooked by the chair. And this is problematic because obviously it signals to countries that actually they're not all equal in a negotiation context or in a decision-making context, and the opinions of some countries are more easily overlooked than the opinions of others. And so much better than this is to not have exclusive consensus as decision-making. I think even though there are, as mentioned, some attempts to correct the interpretation of consensus, most likely this will not happen soon. And instead, we should have rules of procedure that allow clearly for a vote and encourage or clearly direct the chair to call for a vote when the possibility for consensus has been exhausted. And this is something that exists and that is well practiced under the CITES convention, for example. The second aspect of consensus is the culture of diplomacy. During the INCs, we've heard many times that we have the choice between a deep and narrow treaty, so a very strong text supported by a handful of countries, or a shallow and broad treaty, so a weak text supported by all or nearly all countries. And that's really a false dichotomy, because international diplomacy has its own culture. It's a culture of seeking consensus by all means possible. And so this scenario of an absurdly strong treaty that most countries would never be able to commit to is simply a fiction. It's false and it's being used as a scarecrow. So it's really important to recognize that we're operating in a space where the culture is already strongly, strongly biased towards consensus. And so a consensus will be attempted in all, or at least in most situations. And we need the rules of procedure to balance that out, to balance that culture out, so that we can also have effective decision making, especially when it comes to the ability to amend, to update, to modernize the annexes, where we will have, hopefully, targets to reduce plastic production and lists where we can include plastic products and chemicals, including groups of chemicals, because new science on current harm that's being done is coming out all the time, and we need to be able to make sure that this instrument stays relevant and addresses all the threats that we know about.
Great. Now that we've unpacked the concept of consensus, let us reflect on how this concept has evolved in the context of the Global Plastics Treaty. Since the INC2, a few lower ambition or oil-producing countries have repeatedly sought to delay the progress on the core obligations of the treaty text, particularly on articles that call for a reduction of plastic production and a dedicated fund to implement the treaty. They have been doing this by weaponizing decision-making by consensus only. And I would like to now come to you, Dr. Jamala, to take us through the details of how this progression has played out and continues to play out as we approach an extended session of the INC5 come August this year.
Thank you for the question, Marissa, and thank you to Gaia for having me for this important conversation today. So really, when it comes to this history, it kind of goes back to the first INC, when the rules of procedure for the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee process was first being deliberated. And at this point, the proposed rules were very similar to the classic structure from the Minamata Convention, and there were, of course, a whole slew of rules, but the most controversial ones were Rules 37 concerning the participation of regional economic bloc organizations such as the European Union, the African Union, for example, or and then also Rule 38, which concerned the decision-making process and the voting versus consensus question that you are alluding to. So this was kind of proposed initially in INC1, and then of course the rules came up for a decision as far as adopting them provisionally or fully, so that they would shape the decision-making process from then on. And what ended up happening was we did not get a full adoption of the rules of procedure, but a provisional one, in which, the rules sort of all apply except for rules 38 and 30 and 37, which are the ones that people cannot agree upon. And that puts us in a situation where consensus is the default, because we cannot agree upon the question of consensus versus voting. And this is actually very similar to other UN multilateral environmental agreements in terms of the process, because this is also the case in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, because they were unable to agree on the question of procedural matters following the initial Rio Declaration in 1992. We have proceeded according to consensus for 30 years from that point. Consensus has been the default, and it is obviously significantly stalled progress.
Thank you so much, Dr. J, for taking us down that memory lane as to how, this narrative has sort of progressed and has now come to be the default, even that we're finding ourselves in this global plastics treaty process. And I maybe want to just jump the gun here because we have Mohammed with us that has attended multiple climate COPs, in his years. And, something that you alluded to, Dr. J, is that this has also been the default, that we've seen at, within the climate negotiation space or within the Paris Agreement that we're fond of calling this. So maybe Mohammed, just coming to you, in all your years of attending the climate COPs, how have you seen, exclusive consensus ruining the effectiveness of, real decisions being taken in the context of the climate COPs for that matter? And how do you see that also playing out, when we come to the Global Plastics Treaty? What are your thoughts around that?
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you a lot, Melissa, and thank you for the invitation as well. I think it's a very important discussion, and it's important to draw reference to existing case studies of how this has played out in other multilateral processes. In the UNFCCC, so the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which of course had the Kyoto Protocol as a follow-up and the Paris Agreement, the decision-making authority for the COPs and for the agreement itself was through consensus. At the very beginning of the process, countries were trying to negotiate a voting, based mechanism to decide on things, but that didn't pass, and it was consensus-based. So what did this do? How did this affect the sort of multilateral action on climate? Well, it took us 28 editions of COPs to mention fossil fuel in text, even though scientifically, and we know very well that fossil fuel is the primary reason behind climate change, and it's the primary reason behind a lot of the environmental issues we're facing. But it was very easy, and I say it carefully, it was actually easy for countries that have vested interest in expanding or further proliferation of fossil fuels to veto. And here it's a very important term, veto, even though it's not the legal term to be used, it's not actually reflecting it very accurately. Countries don't have a veto power, but that is essentially what they're able to do. They're able to veto a decision that maybe all other countries that have agreed to, but one country has disagreed. So their lack of agreement and their lack of alignment with other countries or what other countries have proposed means that they can stop an entire resolution, decision, or an action plan or a work program. And this has happened repeatedly over the years in the UNFCCC. I mean, without mentioning the names of countries, it's quite predictable, but mostly oil producing countries have consistently and repeatedly stopped any ambition on reducing the production or even mentioning fossil fuel in the treaty text, phasing down or phasing out, etc. We've seen this recently and even in the past, but more recently, we've seen it in COP26 when there was the headline decision on coal, where a lot of countries agreed at the very end, after all countries clearly shown that they're willing to make a compromise, even the producing countries, one country came out and, without mentioning its name, said, no, we're not agreeing on this. On the last day, they did not agree to the decision. That means that the decision had to be dropped down. The language had to be weakened, and the entire framework of the decision was weakened around reduction in coal and usage of coal. So it's extremely problematic because it gives authority to blockers, countries that have no interest in progressing negotiations around quite important issues. So when we're talking about the INC process, we're talking about a global problem. Plastic pollution is a problem that we're all facing. It's a problem that is affecting our health directly and the environment. But maybe in certain countries that are not as affected, and countries that have vested interest in expanding plastic production before anything else, they are able to stop the process if we do not have a voting-based mechanism in place. And that is the challenge we face. And if we look at the climate space as an example, as I just mentioned, repeatedly, one country has been able to stop any progress on different tracks of negotiation. And this is something we should learn from. And we should learn from also in finding a more acceptable way of having a voting-based mechanism in place, but not completely sidelining that and just focusing on having consensus-based. Consensus-based means we're not only going to get the one thing we all agree on, we're going to get the weakest thing that most probably we will not even comply with. It usually means that we will not even comply with these things that we're agreeing on.
Yeah, heard loud and clear there, Mohammed. You know, I just want to touch on something you said, which was the default of consensus ideally gives the authority to blockers, for these countries to continue pushing for their vested interests to be prioritized, you know. And when we have to really take things into consideration in the broader scheme of things, their vested interests come above the cost of what? The cost of who? And I want to now turn this to Kabir, who has been working with, you know, vulnerable groups, particularly fence line groups and waste picker groups. How, Kabir, for you, have you found that this notion that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed, impacting the participation of rights holder groups such as waste pickers in the course of the plastic treaty negotiations, while we're all waiting for, and the world continues to wait for, urgent action to address the plastics crisis, we continue being held hostage, you know, by a small group of countries whose vested interests seem to be being prioritized over people, for that matter. And what's your perspectives on this? And how has waste picker groups been, you know, facing challenges from this continuous stalling tactic?
See, there are two parts to response to this question. One is that on the question of waste pickers in the plastics treaty negotiation, we generally got a positive response from member states. And till the last, I think it was in the draft circulated by the chair on at the last dates of November, we had the discussion on the mandatory provision for just transition for waste pickers and other workers. And then on 1st December, the new text comes in, which was a surprise for a lot of countries that have been very supportive of waste pickers, who are a substantial number in the room, were disappointed with the lack of their inputs not being reflected, and one of them being just transition, a mandatory commitment for just transition for waste pickers. So that was one set of things happening inside the negotiation. The other thing which is happening on the ground is that because there is the momentum which has been there since UNIA, last UNIA, on the plastic pollution question. We are losing that momentum, and there are a lot of things happening domestically in many countries where they are bringing legislations on plastic waste management, on plastic credits, on anything which sometimes is not credible, say plastics credit, for example, as a part of extended producer's responsibility. These legislations are coming all over the world, and there is no sort of what we see is that there are some basic elements missing, which countries could have agreed internationally upon and rolled out in the specific programs that they have on EPR or plastic waste management. So it's a bit of a challenge in that context that there is diversity of legislations coming and there is this goodwill to do things, but there could have been a possibility to bring in some level of universal set of principles which plastics treaty brings in. So that's the challenge what we see at one at national level and one in plastics treaty negotiations.
Thanks, Kabir, for chiming in on that and giving us the context of how things have been evolving when it has come to the article on just transition, specifically around the language provisions that waste pickers have been trying to call for in that, coupled with this consensus looming over us. I want to now maybe turn back to Serene and just go back a little bit in history and in keeping with history, we've seen alternative decision-making methods that have been adopted to break free from the shackles of consensus that upholds a spirit of negotiating in good faith. And from your research and from your experience, Serene, what can you tell us have been some of the sort of case studies historically that have where we've seen alternative decision-making methods come into play so that we can, really get through with this consensus decision-making only protocol that's being called for in the space of the plastics treaty right now?
One example we have of the interplay between voting and consensus in treaty negotiations is the final phase of the negotiations on the Arms Trade Treaty in 2012 and 2013. The first few years were actually taken up by exchanges of views and technical meetings, but didn't have negotiations proper. So in 2012, the US, at the time under President Obama, imposed consensus as a condition for their participation. And that had the effect of really weakening the text. And in particular, of countries compromising, acceding to the US request to exclude ammunition from the scope, even though countries from regions severely affected by armed violence, like Africa and Latin America and the Caribbean, really wanted ammunition to stay within the scope. So until the final hours of negotiation, the mode of decision-making remained consensus, and there was an effort to try to adopt the text by consensus until three countries blocked the agreement because they were countries that import arms and don't really have domestic production, and so they felt threatened that without arms trade, they wouldn't be able to defend themselves. That wasn't the case at the time of countries that produce arms and export them, who didn't feel so threatened by this treaty. So the negotiating conference ended without a consensus text, but the same text that failed through consensus was put to a vote 6 days later at the UN General Assembly, and it succeeded. And so the vote was really what unlocked these negotiations, but it's worth noting that consensus had already done its damage through the exclusion of ammunition, through generally weakening the text. And the US, which is the country that had imposed this consensus approach, didn't have an intention to ratify, probably, and in the end never ended up ratifying, in fact.
All right, that's quite interesting to note. So there are actually such examples that do exist out there. And I think, a lot of our speakers here today have been really honing in on the fact that there's lessons to be learned from various other MEAs when it comes to this consensus narrative, and they should not be taken mildly. So I want to come back to you, Dr. Jamala. You know, earlier you spoke a little bit about two particular rules under the rules of procedure where decision making is currently in question within the Global Plastics Treaty. And as we know, the rules of procedure has not currently been resolved, nor has it been adopted. It's sort of provisionally in play right now. So why do you think countries are so reluctant to open this up for discussion again when it could actually offer a pathway towards breaking this consensus deadlock on decision making and try and move the negotiations, move the needle on the negotiations, especially on substantive matters, forward? What do you think is holding them back from actually just, you know, opening this up and for a discussion again at INC 5.2 and having a way forward on this?
Yes, I think there are sort of two answers here. One that you would get from most member states themselves, which would be that they simply don't want to open up the discussion again because they don't want to repeat the outcome of INC2 and the just long rounds of discussions with no possible agreement that occurred in Paris. But the sort of second answer, and the real answer, is that what we are seeing is very much a parallel to what Mohammed was talking about with the UNFCCC process, where a number of countries with vested interests in plastic production are simply blocking this part of the process from going forward, precisely because it would offer a way forward, and it would see us able to apply such things in the plastics treaty process as human rights and the precautionary principle and the exercise of strong implementation in the process that would really result in a substantial reduction of plastic production and the production of chemicals and the production of these most toxic and most unnecessary and avoidable plastic products around the world. And so this handful of countries that want to continue plastic production and of course, oil and gas extraction, which is part and parcel to that plastic production, because plastics are manufactured from fossil fuels ultimately. These countries are very specifically blocking progress on those two rules. And specifically with Rule 37, it is to ensure that regional economic blocs do not have a diminished voting power, because the countries that are blocking it are generally in a relatively small minority. And so if the power of regional economic blocs were to be ensured in the process, it would kind of be like the majority of the world deciding to overrule this small group of countries. And of course, it is the same with Rule 38 and voting. Ultimately, this small group of countries wants to make it so that the majority of the world, the vast majority of which want plastics action, are unable to make progress. And it's critical that we not only have voting in this INC, but sort of another thing that we're also facing on the horizon is the question of how the implementation and the Conference of the Parties process will go, precisely because we will face the same questions, and we will have to ultimately populate annexes with chemicals and products and targets for reducing plastic production. So the question needs to be resolved now, you know, because it will not only hamper our ability to move forward in the INC process, but also in the COP process as well.
Thanks, Dr. Jamal. And I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, for a while now, we've been talking about how this small group of minority countries have been, you know, really creating roadblocks in this process. So if I were to flip the coin on its head, and maybe in still keeping with you, Dr. Jamala, what would you say would be some of your recommendations to the majority group of countries, that being the higher ambition countries, noting that no one country has the right to block others from exercising their sovereign right in international agreements? What would you like to say to them, you know, in terms of how we move forward on this?
Yes, that's a great question. I think I would say at the last INC 5.1 in Busan, we saw something really encouraging happen, which was over 100 countries committing to high ambition in the Global Plastics Treaty process, and specifically holding the line on those articles on reducing plastic production and reducing chemicals and reducing products. And I think these countries have formed what is kind of now being referred to as a coalition of the willing. And while it is, you know, really great to see the formation of a coalition of the willing in terms of, you know, declarations and in terms of statements and in terms of, you know, the sort of things that we've seen more on the political level, we have to also ultimately see this coalition of the willing form at the procedural level, at the policy level, for the reasons that I was speaking to earlier. If this is not done, then ultimately we will just kind of keep going around in circles in this process. And also, potentially to the point that Kabir was making earlier, we might see more iterations of the non-paper texts that have come out from the chair that just continue to omit fence line and frontline communities, continue to omit waste pickers, continue to omit such things as human rights and the precautionary principle from the treaty framework. And so, you know, moving forward on these procedural matters is really life and death for these communities, and also pivotal to ensure progress in the process.
Yeah, I think that's a great, you know, sort of interpretation of how we did see, you know, a large group of countries at the last INC really show up and show up strongly for ambition. And maybe, Mohammed, if you could share your thoughts as well on this question, it would just be interesting to note where your thought process is at when it comes to how, you know, we can really, or how basically the high ambition countries can really sort of ramp up their efforts at this next INC 5.2, so we do not see this consensus deadlock prevailing again.
Thank you, Marissa, for the question. I mean, I think we need to be a bit blunt. There is the term negotiating in good faith, right? And that's what the premise of multilateralism has been built around, that you should be coming to negotiate in good faith, even if, I don't know, something is going to affect or you're going to be negatively affected by certain aspects of this treaty or convention. But we're not discussing something that is affecting something that's economic only. We're affecting something that is significantly affecting the health, the well-being, the safety of millions of people, right? So it's a very big and substantive issue. It's a growing problem. And it requires their countries to really let go of certain, and usually there's certain barriers that they put up with regards to multilateral negotiation, because they're skeptic of how these things will eventually be translated into action, right? And they usually use a variety of means to slow down and delay the negotiation. So if we're going to negotiate in good faith, I believe we need to be more blunt, more honest in our positions. And there's two parts to look at this. If you're a country that is negatively affected by this treaty and you don't really believe that plastic pollution is a problem, don't negotiate. Don't be part of this agreement. Don't weaken the agreement to a point where it's not even useful anymore. I genuinely believe that the UNFCCC has reached a point where sometimes it causes more harm than good, right? And that's largely because a few countries have been able to dictate the process for the majority of countries. We could reach a similar point if we allow consensus-based decision-making to take place. Because the producers are never going to give up any sort of ambition with regards to actually tackling the problem from the source. On the other end, ambitious countries need to stand their ground. They need to understand that the few times we have made compromises for the few, we have never made progress forward in multilateralism. It's the few that need to usually make bigger compromises for the many. And especially in this regard, when it comes to an issue that is felt by so many people in so many countries. And on the other hand, the producers are actually not as many. And they're usually just exaggerating the level of impact on their economy when taking into consideration as well that such a treaty gives them a meaningful way to start planting a framework for a transition or just transition of some sort. But back to the main question, if we are to negotiate in good faith and to uphold these things that we usually say, then we need to be more blunt. And if we don't, if I'm a country that believes that this treaty, I'm not benefiting from this treaty, it's affecting me, I think it's well within the right just not to negotiate, not to sign the treaty eventually, rather than weakening it. Usually countries don't follow on this, but I believe that is the most, that's the healthiest way to proceed. Ambitious countries that are already holding their ground and have shown us how ambitious they can be in INC5, I think they can continue to hold their ground. They should not compromise. I think at the moment, we're at the time where the global order of multilateralism is being tested. But that should not be an excuse to find this common denominator where the highest ambition is going to be some form of waste management intervention and cutting down all the other key articles that we know scientifically, enough research is out there. If we don't work on that on upstream, we cannot really end the problem.
I don't think I could have said it better, Mohammed. I think the time to be blunt is now, and we have to just stop tiptoeing around this crisis as if it is something that's not real and as if it is something that is not affecting our own health as human beings and affecting our surrounding environment. I think you couldn't have hit the nail on the head any better than that. So thank you so much for that brutally honest opinion. And I think there was, you know, you mentioned how we move forward when it comes to just transition as well. And we really need, you know, ambitious countries to toe the line and to hold fort when it comes to the concept of just transition. And, you know, I want to end off by just posing this last question to you, Kabir, and get your thoughts around this. How will moving past this consensus deadlock secure a treaty that waste picker groups can not only be proud of, but also be equitably integrated into? And if you could just end us off on that note, that would be great.
See, as the earlier speaker spoke, what Mohammed Kamal said, one big concern that we have is that it's cutting down on ambition. I mean, we already see what has happened is from a mandatory provision which enjoyed a broad support, just transition became a voluntary provision, and that's not something we desire. One thing, almost all the continents have waste pickers, and some or the other form informality exists. And in some or the other form, waste pickers recover recyclable and reusable materials from street. A substantial amount of it is plastics. And that sort of requires some additional interventions for states to do to ensure that there is a just transition of workers who have been historically engaged in recovery. Now, doing away and going through an approach where we water down provisions, which is what is happening with the consensus-based approach, that we may or may not have the action that is required at this point of time, because the number of way speakers is significantly high. It's around 40 million people who are working as way speakers, and the people who are dependents is way bigger than that. So to make sure that population which has played such an important role in the process is recognized and given, there has to be some mandatory universal provisions which are carried out. And it won't happen if we stay with the consensus-driven approach, and that there is a desire, and substantially in Global South, there is a huge desire to do something on the question of waste pickers. And the governments need to move the needle now and see that we go towards something called voting approach to make it happen, to make the ambition on just transition possible.
Thank you so much, Kabir. And I think ambition all round is needed, whether it is just transition or whether it is a reduction on plastic production or whether it is phasing out some of the most harmful and problematic plastic substances and chemicals that we're finding in plastics. And we can only move on this and ensure that we have as high of an ambition as possible on these measures and a strong treaty on these measures by ensuring that, you know, we're not leaving everything to this default consensus decision-making mechanism that has ensued for generations now in multilateralism. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you to our listeners for listening to the Africa for Zero Waste podcast. So be sure to join us next time. Until then, this is Marissa Naidoo.